So when I hand over, start fucking.
Hello.
Wait. How does that go? At least you got the fuck ups out of the way early. Oh, fuck. I stepped on the dog's bowl.
From the burning mesas of the Arizona desert to the slot machine-clad boardwalks of New Jersey, it's the Imaginarium with Scott and Todd. I'm Scott Colbert.
And I'm the horror nerd, Todd Starooch.
And to put an epilogue to my multi-week CVS extravaganza story.
Here we go.
Well, there's not much to say about it, actually. Everything got taken care of. I have my medication, so it all got straightened out. But it's one of those things, talking to the woman in customer relations, she's telling me that they had over 1,000 customers that were going over to the new store. So, you know, they were swamped. And I understand that. And I figured that was part of the problem. But I also, in the back of my mind, thinking, that's not my fucking problem. You know,
right?
If it's that bad, you know, get more people in the store. You know, even if you get, you know, pull people from other CVSs until everything gets settled down. Because she said it could take up to 4 to 6 weeks before everything goes back to normal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, there's nothing normal with CVS, so.
And folks, what one thing we really need, we definitely need to make sure that Scott stays on his meds.
Yes. Yes, you do.
Otherwise, yes. Yeah, it is not pretty. Mm. So, normally we, at the beginning of every show, because everyone in music and TV and movies that we like is all getting old, we talk about celebrity deaths. And there's one that happened almost a month ago that I cannot believe we didn't mention. At least I don't think we did. I mean, I can't remember what I had for breakfast today. So it wouldn't be shocking if we talked about it and I just couldn't remember. But that's Jerry Lee Lewis.
No, we didn't.
The killer. Yeah. Because that, talk about a rock and roll icon.
Oh, absolutely.
Jerry Lee Lewis. And he's one of those guys that, A, I thought was a lot older than he was. I mean, he was 87 when he died, which is up there. But for some reason, I thought he was like 96. And also that he had already died.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, so Jerry Lee Lewis, man, was like the first rock and roll wild man, you know, who just didn't give a fuck. He's like, you know what? Not only am I going to marry my first cousin, but she's only 13. And technically, my previous marriage isn't fully dissolved yet. And guess what? I don't give a shit. I'm doing it. I'm like, okay.
He would have had a very short career if he came out today.
Right? He'd have been canceled before the first album hit the airwaves. You know?
Yeah.
But and his is one of the, I think, the better rock and roll biopics. I think Dennis Quaid did a great job.
Great Balls of Fire.
Great Balls of Fire, yeah.
I have Great Balls of Fire.
Listen, you might. Didn't we just discuss you taking meds for that?
Yeah, well, I do have a topical ointment for it.
Oh, okay. Great. Great.
And if I'm you need
someone
in
to apply
speak.
That for you, let me know.
That's what my cat is for.
Oh, God. Dude. Oh, you know what? I don't even know how long it took to go into the ditch because, of course, I forgot to start the timer.
Well, not very long this time.
No. Maybe 4.5 minutes or something like that.
But so. Imagine if Jerry Lee Lewis had come on the scene now and he got canceled for marrying a 13-year-old first cousin. You know, look, we may never have ever heard Great Balls of Fire or any of the other of his hits or, you know, hear his piano playing. You know, it just... It makes you wonder, with all the people that they cancel or want to cancel, what we may miss out on.
For sure, man. And look, I'm not trying to, you know, portray. Oh, hold on a second. Breaking news. We have a very special guest.
Breaking wind.
Breaking news. We have a special guest coming on that you did not know about.
Oh, really?
Yes. So we'll give him a minute to connect to the audio. And there he is, the one and only Jeremiah Kipp.
Jeremiah! Hey, holy shit! Yay!
Hey, you guys.
Hey, man.
How you doing?
I'm great. Congratulations on 8 years. I mean, time flies, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It flew by. It absolutely flew by.
I mean, 8 years... You know, I mean, it, I'm in my 40s now, and it feels like time is going by in the blink of an eye. And yet, at the same time, we went through this pandemic that felt like 7 years in two. So, what a time is flexible, isn't it?
It is. Todd and I talk about that all the time on the show because, you know, we talk about celebrities who have died, and we look at their ages and we think, how the fuck can they be that old when, you know, cause that means that we're getting older too, and that can't happen.
Oh, I mean, yeah, you know, it affects us all. Have you guys ever talked to anyone on the show who has passed away in the 8 years that you've been doing this?
That's a good question. Yes.
I don't think fact, so.
Yes.
I mean, lucky us.
Yeah, I don't think
We're all kicking.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's possible, and I just don't remember, Jeremiah, but I was telling Scott before, I don't remember what I did earlier today.
Said, yes, we did.
Okay, well, I don't listen to anything
you say. Who was it? Who was it? Let's take a moment.
It was Joe Adams, my good friend Joe Adams.
Wow.
Was the third or fourth guest on the Imaginarium.
So that was before me. So, okay, that's why I didn't remember.
He had been on after you as well.
You're making that up.
No, I'm not. I'm not.
Okay. Well, what's one good memory you had of him on your show?
Oh, Jesus, that's easy. The story he told about Harlan Ellison and the stained glass window that he made for him. Yeah, he made us up. A stained glass window for Harlan Ellison, and Harlan had it installed in his bedroom, and it had a cross in it, and as the sun came in, it would shine down on his bed, and Harlan would lay there like he was crucified on the cross.
So every day Harlan Ellison would wake up and feel the light coming from Joe's artwork. That's incredible.
It is. And considering he's he was an atheist, Harlan, the fact that he would have that.
Wow.
Yeah. Harlan Ellison, you know, he's an interesting cat because he was both incredibly inspiring in the way that he stood for something in the world. And also, you were like, every day that you didn't meet Harlan Ellison, you were probably a little bit grateful because he sounds like such a pain in the ass. But I identified with him really strongly. I thought he was a beautiful writer. Like I loved his horror fiction that was so strange and so provocative. And then also as a person who walks through the world being 5'4", you know, like he definitely seemed like a very short person who had, you know, a chip on his shoulder about some of that stuff. And
from a very early age.
Yeah. Like, I think he grew up in a time where if you were a short person, you either had to act like Napoleon or you were seen as less than, you know. And I think the world has evolved a lot since then. You know, I feel like everybody can be their own person, and you know, like I think there are less judgments about that sort of thing. But like, you know, I felt a real sympathy to him for being like, I have to be the smartest and the most powerful argumentative figure, you know, and I can't let anybody push me around ever, you know. But like, so even if he came off as a bit of an asshole, you certainly can't argue with his work, which was like, he had some of the most beautiful and dangerous science fiction and horror writing that I'd ever read. It certainly opened doors for me.
Did you ever read any of his nonfiction?
Yeah, he wrote great essays in Twilight Zone magazine. I don't know if you guys remember that back in the 80s.
I do.
But he wrote a really great essay about Stephen King film adaptations that was called "Why Don't Children Look Like Their Parents?" It's a beautiful piece of writing because it was like, why is it that so many of the film adaptations of Stephen King can't quite capture the very specific lived-in milieu of his work? And I agree. I think it's very hard to capture, you know, like it's very hard to capture that specific main inflection without it seeming like a cartoon or a caricature. And yet you read Pet Sematary and it's the most terrifying novel that you'll ever see. I thought Mary Lambert's film was really good, but the book is just an unstoppable force.
Yeah.
I think there've been many good Stephen King adaptations, but I took Harlan Ellison's point, which is that there's an inherent difference between John Carpenter's Christine and Stephen King's Christine, and David Cronenberg's The Dead Zone, and Stephen King's The Dead Zone, and Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, and Stephen King's The Shining. The filmmaker's imprint on those books is so powerful that you know, it's like yeah, that, you know, you read the books and you have a completely different experience. And Scott, I don't know if you felt that way. I mean, I don't know if your work has been adapted into other mediums, but you know, but it also feels like your stories are so provocative that no filmmaker would dare. They'd feel like they would get arrested. I think film directors would fear they would get arrested for representing your work as a movie.
Well, Todd wants to make barbed wire kisses into a movie. Although he said he has, he said he has a different ending for it, but he still hasn't told me what it is.
Well, I kind of had an idea. Now, when I said that, I didn't, and then I realized they said, you know what, that is insulting, and I didn't want to sound like I could have written the book or the ending better than you did, Scott. What I meant was, like, I had a different version of things happening within the universe you created, you know? So, because I hate that. Like, Tom Ryan and I talk about that all the time when we do a Q&A at a screening and someone says, well, you know, how I would have ended it a little differently. And I'm like, oh, good. Well, when you write your movie, you can, you know, you can have your own ending. And good luck with that.
I know I find that such a fair response because like it's if you get feedback on something, like something that you've written or something that you've made, and that response is a completely different movie. It's like, well, there's room enough for both of us in this world. Go make that thing. Sure. Go write that thing. Honestly, there've been so many good, like, and there've been so many good pieces of writing that were in response to something else, you know? So when, you know, back to Stephen King, when he was like bouncing the ball off of Dracula to make Salem's Lot, you know, those are two very interesting works of, you know, literature. And when Sheridan DeFanu wrote Camilla in response to the vampire myth, it's like that you couldn't get a story more different than Dracula that's so provocative, interesting. So I think that should be encouraged. I mean, I do get pissed off like you and Tom Ryan do. It's like, well, why didn't you do this? It's like, well, why don't you go fuck yourself? But
it's one, you know, thing to say. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but
no, not at all. But deep in my heart, I do believe that, like, if that inspires someone to go make something else, then I'm always on board for that, because there's so many interesting pieces of work that are in response to other things that have been previously made.
And you know what happens? Those people who make comments like that, they never make movies. They just become critics.
I see you have a chip on your shoulder. Wow. About I don't have a problem with film critics. They have their job and I have my job. What I would be more pissed off about is if I were someone like Clive Barker, who made such, I mean, like when you read his stories and his books, they're so rich and they're so fascinating and they're so queer. And, you know, and then you see some of the films are excellent, like Hellraiser and Candyman are wonderful movies. But, you know, Rawhead Rex is an incredible story. And then when you see the film of it, you're like, God, they fucked that up. You know,
yeah, and, for sure.
And it's like, yeah, when somebody takes something by a writer and bastardizes it into something else, there is a part of me that's like, I can't quite get behind it the same way I am. Like, go make your own thing. It's like, well, you fucked up the thing that was like beautiful about that work of art in the first place because you were timid or, you know, you were afraid to put that sort of stuff out into the world, you know. And Rawhead Rex is definitely a story that deserves its own movie. People always ask me, like, what would you like to adapt into a film? And that's one that I would love to take a crack at someday. Oh. I think it's just such a powerful story.
I would love for you to agree. That would be awesome.
Back to Scott's work real quick, Jeremiah. I'm not even kidding about this. I had it in my head. If I had won like the $2 billion Powerball, I would have written a check and dared some filmmaker to actually make Errors of the Flesh.
Hey man, you know, if David Cronenberg can make J.G. Ballard's Crash and fucking Naked Lunch, you know, then
fair enough
possible. I think the world is ready for like a really, you know, I mean, like movies, you know, it's like, I think the elevated horror, as much as I love, I mean, I don't like that term, but I like those kinds of movies. I feel like that is like winding down, and something like Terrifier 2 is speaking to audiences right now. And I'm wondering if like it is a time for like not only slasher movies to come back, but also like extremely provocative work. We've all been through a pandemic and fucked up decade of weird times of political divide. It's like maybe what we really need right now is an explosive, dangerous, crazy ass movie with a significant budget. I wonder if the world is just waiting for that sort of thing. So don't rule it out, you guys. Like Todd, if you can make it happen, and Scott, you know, you never know. Like somebody may like have that really bold take on your work and put something out there and scare the shit out of everybody and make everybody like want to run into bury themselves in a hole or cover themselves in Drano.
Oh God.
Well, if either one of us win that $2 billion lottery, we would have you direct, Jeremiah.
Hey man, I am here for it.
Oh, it's gonna happen. So Jeremiah, you mentioned Terrifier 2.
Yeah.
So what is your take on that, you know, and the extraordinary success that an indie film is having, you know, what a run they're on.
Yeah, I just think it's a foretold conclusion. You know, it's like that the road was paved for Terrifier 2 to be enormously successful because of what it was emerging from. You know, it's like we've seen a lot of, I mean, I love films like Hereditary and The Witch and all that stuff. And I enjoy, you know, like really populist horror, like Barbarian and, you know, even Halloween Ends, you know, it's a divisive movie. I didn't particularly care for it, but I liked they were trying to do something different. But those are like popular, like poppy, not too dangerous movies. And when Terrifier 2 came upon us, you know, and became such a gigantic box office success, I was like, gosh, we're so hungry for that, aren't we? We're so hungry for an experience that is big and gross and explosive and has no fucks to give about anything other than sensory, pure sensory experience. And I also think that we haven't had an iconic horror character in a long time. I think Art the Clown is filling us a void. Like, we haven't had a Freddy Krueger or a Jason Voorhees or a Candyman, you know, in quite a while. And for Art the Clown to step up and be like something that you could see a toy made out of or a collectible, you know, I'm like, yeah, you know, that's exciting. So whether people like the movie or don't like the movie, you can't deny the ravenous hunger that people are having for that sort of thing. And I hope that it opens the floodgates for independent films to, like, you know, I would rather see like 25 films at the budget of Terrifier 2, like all, you know, to varying levels of success than one Halloween Ends, which kind of costs as much as, like, you know, you could make 25 Terrifier 2s one Halloween Ends, you know, and that's an IP that, you know, I mean, again, it's like if people, I mean, they're trying to do something different, but that intellectual property has been around forever. It's like, I think people are starving for new things, you know, and Terrifier 2 is certainly that, you know. And I think it goes beyond love it or hate it. I think it goes to speaking to something the audience really, really wants right now. I think the other thing, you know, the other thing that I hope happens in the next like couple of years are really, really fun horror movies like Gremlins. You know, like Gremlins came in and like it was just such a popular entertainment, but it was so anarchic and it was like so willing to be a food fight of a movie. And I wish that big blockbuster entertainments would go in that direction as well. If they can rediscover the fun of horror, like that would be great, because we've had a decade of, and you know, Slapface is certainly one of those. It's like, man, what a downer. You know, I feel so depressed, you know, and I'm very proud of my movie and I love that we may put it out into the world, but I'm also ready myself to be like, yeah, you know, I want to do something that's big and fun and explosive and, you know, like, you know, like, and populist, you know, and while I don't, you know, Terrifier 2 is like leaning all the way into, we're going to have the most spectacular gore every 10 minutes, which I'm all about, you know, it's like, yes, like let's be fearless and let's go all the way there. You know, like, I'm also like, let's get back to, you know, like, you just don't see any movies these days that are like Waxwork, you know, which is like, you watch that. Like, what a delight that movie is, you know, or even, you know, Friday the 13th Part 4, which is like watching the Super Bowl, you know, it's like, I'm here for, you know, I hope the studios take the idea. I mean, like, so I hope independent films like go for it the way Terrifier 2 did. And I hope studio films are like more willing to take risks. You know, it's like go out there and like, you know, learn from Terrifier 2 and learn that audiences want something that they feel is more tangible. They don't want a Big Mac. You know, they want something that's either like, you know, Terrifier 2 is just rough and ready. And I was so excited. I mean, when that movie was achieving the box office success that it was, I was like, yes, absolutely. I'm so, you know, and horror has done very well this year, which is also really exciting for all of us.
Well, I think there's going to be another renaissance of movies like, well, there's certainly going to be a lot of ripoffs of Terrifier 2 coming up. Because,
hey, you know, I have no problem with that, because Friday the 13th came out and that led to The Prowler and The Burning and a bunch of other.
The, like, Mutilator. Pretty, yeah.
Oh, my God. That movie is like, right? You know, like movies that, some of which I find even better than Friday the 13th, you know, it's like, it led to a lot of exciting, like, you know, there were a bunch of knockoffs, but like some of those knockoffs, you know, it's like, just because it's inspired by something else doesn't mean it can't be creative and daring in its own right. So if there's a bunch of Terrifier 2 type movies, sure, like, let's see if they can come up with a character that's equally iconic. Let's see if they can push it as surreal as The Nightmare on Elm Street was, with, you know, a character as bullying and Johnny Carson like as Freddy Krueger. Let's see what they come up with. I'm, you know, if people are ripping it off, and finding their own voice with it, then that could be really exciting.
And listen, Jaws led to one of my favorite genres, and that is bad shark movies.
Oh my God.
Well, I will watch any bad shark movie on the Sci-Fi Channel that you can throw at me. I don't care. I will watch.
But also fucking Piranha was directed by Joe Dante,
first feature,
and John Sayles, his first writing assignment. So like, hey, you know, Corman or whoever it was like, let's knock off Jaws, but with piranhas. But they hired a great director and a great writer. And that movie is like, I mean, it's very cheap and it's very, you know, but it's you feel Joe Dante's powerful voice in it. And it led to him getting hired on The Howling. You know, John Sayles also led to him getting hired on The Howling and led to an enormously great career in non-genre films. So, yeah, like if there's knockoffs and, you know, and also like, look, guys, you know, as art house as I am and as snobby as I am, like I was like Sharknado, Sharktopus, you know, like whatever, you know, Shark Dracula, Shark Frankenstein, like bring it on.
Yeah, man. Like I have a group of friends, my brother-in-law and three or four other guys. We have been getting together for more than 25 years.
Yeah.
To just watch the most ridiculous, over-the-top horror movies that we can find. We love good shit horror. You know what I mean? Like,
there's a place for it.
Oh, there absolutely is. Now, some of them are just really just not worth the time, but a lot of them are just fun. It's like Jeremiah Scott and I talk about this all the time. Like, now we all realize that the social media can be just a cesspool, but
sure.
You mentioned fun horror. I want to know when horror fans stopped having fun. Like, everybody goes to the movies now to watch a movie, not to just for the joy of it, but so the minute the credits roll, they can jump on their phone and talk about how much they fucking hated it.
Yeah. And that,
you know,
and my feeling about that is like, that stuff is like the waves come in and the waves go out. There's always been trolls. I mean, like, look, man, when John Carpenter did The Thing 1982, everybody was talking about how much that sucked. You know, if you asked people in 1982 what they thought of that movie, they'd say, what a piece of dog shit. And now everybody's like, that is one of the top five best horror films ever made. So like what people are saying right now on social media, all that destructive trolling shit, you know, it's like that stuff is like a, you know, it's like one grain of sand on the beach. It's like it does not really matter because in the fullness of time, you know, that's when we really discover like what movies are worth. You know, a lot of films, when they came out, were trashed. Like fucking Hitchcock's Vertigo. Everybody's like, pretentious failure. And now people are like, top one movie of all time, you know? So
yeah, fair enough.
People are saying their shit on social media. I'm like, you know, that's so transitory. A week from now, we're not even going to remember like what you've said.
I think a week is too long.
I feel personally
maybe 48 hours at most.
Scott, you're definitely like, you know, speaking of the passage of time, that's definitely like old man Scott talking, you know, it's like, I'll tell you, those kids these days, you know, like 24 hours later, they forgot what they did in the first place. Well, get off my fucking lawn.
Exactly.
I love you, man.
So, Jeremiah, you've got some projects coming up. What, tell the listeners what you're working on.
Yeah, there's a couple things coming down the pike. Film I shot earlier this year in Savannah, Georgia. My latest feature is called The Boo Hag, and that's based in Southern Gothic mythos.
Really looking forward to that one. I remember when you were down there shooting. Well, you called in when we did the our 300th episode.
Yeah, that was
called in from the set.
That's right. Yeah. Like, I was so happy to be there. You know, it was really great to hear from you guys. It was like a postcard from home. but yeah, we're doing special effects for that film right now. There's a lot of post effects. There's a monster in it that requires a lot of it's a ghost like creature. So we're in the middle of that right now. And then there's a short that I did starring Keith David of The Thing that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
And I can say that he is an actor's actor, like a really profound, I mean, great actor and a really powerful person, you know, like, so we did a non-genre film with him. Like he was, it was kind of like that David Lean movie, Brief Encounter. It's him and Catherine Irby from Law and Order Criminal Intent, and kind of like a almost rom-com, you know, almost meet cute between them. And Keith really wanted to, he really wanted to do it because he felt like he doesn't often get to show his romantic side and his sensitivity. And I would argue that whether he's, you know, I would argue that he's always been a very sensitive actor. Like he brings such humanity to every role that you've ever seen him do. But, you know, the thing that's nice, you know, the thing I can't say about Keith David is that, you know, when you meet your, I mean, like, listen, he's like, yeah, I've had the opportunity to work with a few people that were childhood heroes of mine. And The Thing is an important movie to me. And Childs is an important character to me. And They Live is one of my favorite John Carpenter movies. So I was like, you know, I was really hoping that I would have a good experience with Keith David. And as it turns out, he's a, you know, he's just like, he's there for it. You know, he is there to play. And, you know, really intense guy, but also a really deeply soulful, beautiful person. So I can't wait to share that with everybody. And I loved my experience with Keith David. I hope we get to work together again. We'll see, you know, we'll see what's in the cards for us. But anytime, any place, any project, I would definitely play with him again. And then last is, we're in pre-production on another feature that it's an adaptation of a video game called The Mortuary Assistant. It was a pretty, I'm not a gamer. So, you know, like when they first approached me saying, would you like to adapt this video game? I was like, I'm not interested in evil. You know, it's like the film, you know, it's like, how many bad video game movies have there been? But then I watched the gameplay and I was like, oh, I can see why they wanted me for this, because it's really scary and it's very character driven and it's very indie. And I was like, wow, this really reminds me of stuff like that Ty West movie, House of the Devil, you know? And I was like, wow, I actually think I can bring something to this. And I loved working with the game creator, Brian Clark, who's a great artist and a really smart guy. And that game, like when I watched the game, I was like, this feels like a movie. It doesn't feel like, it feels like it could easily be taken into a direction. And then Brian Clark was also supportive. He was like, you know, the movie is the movie and the game is the game. So take it and run with it and make it into a film. Don't make it into a video game film adaptation. Make it into its own movie that can exist as a companion piece to the game. And I felt enormous support from him, and the producers are really great. It's Epic Pictures, and their horror subdivision is called Dread. And I've worked with them before. They were the sales agent on Slapface and were instrumental in that movie getting out into the world. So it was working with people who believed in me and believed in my work and hired me to write and direct this thing. And it is that for me. It is it's scary, and it's intended to be fun. Disturbing fun entertainment. You know, it's more, I wouldn't describe it as a playful film, but anything after Slapface would feel playful, because I think I succeeded in making the most depressing movie ever. You know, again, that was our intention, and we cared.
Slapface is not a good date movie, Jeremiah.
Yeah, it's not a feel good movie, but it's a feel something movie. So when people left the theater crying after Slapface, I took that as the win. You know, but on this one, you know, it's our goal is to create more of an Evil Dead type experience, where it's like where you're swept up into the madness and the chaos. Nice. But I'm really enjoying every step of the journey. I've been loving writing the script, and I've been loving working with these producers who are so supportive. So yeah, like three projects that I really care about, all of which came about because of Slapface. You know, it's like that movie opened a lot of doors for me, and I, you know, look forward to continuing. We'll see what happens next.
That's good stuff, awesome, man. That's really awesome. Pretty quick. Like, that game only just came out. I haven't played it, but I'm aware of it. But it's Like, people say it's excellent. So,
oh, it's scary as hell. Yeah, like,
that's what I hear. I saw some brief clips of it, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to wear a diaper when I play it.
Yeah, for sure. Be prepared to have nightmares for a week.
I will have to watch some gameplay footage of that.
Yeah, it's excellent.
And I like what you just said about it being its own thing, because let's just say, like, video game to film adaptations are spotty at best.
Yeah, you know? I mean, fucking Super Mario Brothers, you guys, like, horrible. Street Fighter, oh my god. I mean, the films back in the day that were game adaptations, it's it felt like it was impossible to make a good game adaptation. I think there's, you know, I think the trick is to honor the spirit of the game, but like go, you know, make a movie, you know, like don't try to do fan service for a game, because that's a recipe for disaster. It's only going to lead to people hating the fact that, you know, it's like, make a good game and make a good movie and let them be related to each other. And having the support of the game creator, like, he's read every single draft of the script and he's been supportive every step of the way. So, you know, I felt like if he is happy with the film and he feels honored and respected by the film, like, that's, you know, that's the most I could, you know, that's number one in my book, is like him feeling satisfied. And, you know, I love it too. So we'll see how the world responds to it. But so far, I'm enjoying the shit out of it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Do you have a start date for shooting on that?
I can't say. My non-disclosure agreement prohibits me from saying any more than that. Like, you know, I can say that I'm writing it and I'm directing it because that's what's been announced to the world. And I can say it's a loving companion to the game. But that's I think that's all I can say. I've occasionally tried to drop very cryptic hints on social media, but the producers have me on a very tight leash. You know, they want to keep the surprises for when the movie premieres.
Fair enough. Hey, no, if Tom Holland can do it, you can do it.
Oh, I love Tom Holland. I mean, Tom Holland is great.
I am still waiting. They teased it forever. I would love to see. See, I'm a fan. I just miss like the old school like adventure movies. I'd like to see Pitfall.
Oh my god! Think about it,
into a movie, right?
That would be incredible.
How cool would it be? Right?
A good Pitfall movie,
right?
Like with a good director. Oh my gosh, that would be amazing.
Could be like a Raiders of the Lost Ark type of thing.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we need to. Like, I know they're doing another Indiana Jones movie. I'm not on board for it, but like, but doing something in the spirit of Raiders of the Lost Ark, like, we need that right now. I mean, I'll never forget how I felt when I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark when I was a little kid. It was a breathtaking experience. One of my best movie experiences of all time.
Well, unfortunately, they're doing the de-aging CGI on Harrison.
My God, it's so tough. So tough.
So I
got one question for you guys to wrap it up. So everybody in the horror world has accepted that Halloween 3 is a classic. You know, like, everybody knows now that Halloween 3 is a good movie, and like it was underappreciated for years. What do you guys think is a movie that has been shit on that deserves a second chance, and maybe in another couple of years or 10 years or whatever will be rediscovered and people will say like, wow, that was way better than we gave it credit for?
Ooh.
I'll say mine first while you guys think about it.
Go ahead.
I just saw Psycho 3 again, not too long ago. And Psycho, of course, is a classic, and Psycho 2 is an extremely respectable movie. But, Psycho 3, I watched it and I was like, wow, this movie is like the gritty, grimy, sleazy Jim Thompson novel version of the Psycho series. And I thought the supporting cast was phenomenal. Like, Jeff Fahey, I thought, was a perfect anti-hero. Diana Scarwood is terrific as the anti-Marion Crane. And the music is by Carter Burwell, who did the music for Blood Simple and all the Coen Brothers movies. And it has a real Blood Simple vibe to it. So I watched that again and I was like, wow, this movie is way better than Psycho 3 has any right to be. And I was like, wow, it's I now that Halloween 3 is accepted critically, I was like, Psycho 3, now that Halloween 3 is accepted, I'm like, well, I'm going to push Psycho 3 now. Some people are pushing Blair Witch 2, but I can't see it. I was like, that movie was a turkey as far as I was concerned.
I love Psycho 3. Any movie that starts off with a nun shouting, there is no God, is okay in my book.
Yes, you are my people.
Yeah. And I just loved, well, Anthony Hopkins, who plays Norman Bates, as everybody knows, directed Psycho 3, many people may not know. And I think he did a fantastic fucking job.
Yeah, he knows the character. He knows the style of the piece. He did a great job.
And he's got a great wicked sense of humor that he infused into that. Like with the bloody ice cubes that the sheriff stuck him on.
That's such a good scene.
And then he's got his mother's arm that he's kind of cradling in the back of the car. It's the very last shot. It's just... It's full of little moments like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so Todd, what is the movie that you would do?
Oh, well, okay, so if we're talking about a movie that was like underappreciated in its time and that I think is better, is so one that comes to mind that I always like and I always take shit for it is Eaten Alive by Tobe Hooper.
Oh, great choice. That is an excellent movie.
Right? Yes. So it's just like, I don't know. It's like so surreal and just crazy. Like, but the problem is he did Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right? So if that movie didn't exist, this one probably would be way more appreciated than it is. But I really love that movie. It's a little over the top. It's still takes place in Texas, and strange weirdo owns a backwoods hotel. Oh, and there's a friendly neighborhood alligator, and Neville Brand plays the villain, and he's just awesome. So
awesome.
I'm gonna go with Eaten Alive. Tobe Hooper. I want to say 74, 75 that came out. I can't quite remember, and I'm too lazy to look it up.
Excellent movie.
Well, my choice is Cujo.
Ooh.
When that came out, it got shit. I mean, it got awful reviews. It did awful at the box office. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And from the first time I saw it, I thought Dee Wallace deserves an Oscar nomination for that performance. Because to me, it is still one of the best female horror performances I've ever seen.
Yeah, so raw.
And that scene in the Pinto with Cujo bashing it and the camera spinning around and around and around and the, Dee and the kid yelling and screaming, that is still one of my all-time favorite scenes.
Oh, it's such a good, it's an excellent, it's so well shot. And Dee Wallace, like what a run she was having between E.T. and The Howling and Cujo. It's like, what a, like an actor who played it so truthfully and so real.
Yeah.
And then Cujo is like her in the car with this kid. Like you're not cutting, it's, there's nobody else. Like there's no, there's nobody else. It's just Dee Wallace, and she's so commanding. Oh my God, yeah, it makes me want to watch Cujo again right now.
It makes me wonder if Lewis Teague had more time to work on the movie, how much different it may have been. I almost think because I think he only had 2 weeks of production time before he started doing it. When he took over from the other director.
I think he's underrated because Alligator very. Is really good and Cat's Eye is really good and Cujo is really good. He's the animal guy.
Yeah, he's I guess really he good is.
Director. Underrated.
Very, very much so.
So speaking of Cujo, Scott, just to of course, shameless self-promotion. I'm very fortunate to have interviewed both Danny Pintaro and Dee Wallace.
Oh,
you know, excellent. And talked about that movie and just, you know, what they went through, you know, shooting it. And there were a couple of times where they were not told exactly what was going to happen, you know, as far as when the, you know, when the dog or, you know, or the puppet was going to hit the car at a certain time or whatever, to get those raw reactions, you know? So it was interesting. So everybody should go to my YouTube channel and watch my interviews with Dee Wallace and Danny Pintaro.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But yeah, that's a good one.
How old was Danny Pintaro when he did that film?
You know, I want to say 8.
Yeah, like excellent child actor performance. But like, I'm gonna listen to your interview because I'm curious, like how that affected him. You know, being a child in this really intense, scary movie that I'm sure must have been difficult to make because they're inside this car. It must have been so hot and so uncomfortable. Right. And you feel the heat and you feel the sweat in that film.
Yep.
So he was 7 because I looked it up real quick. He was born in 76. The movie came out in 83. So
you can look that up, but not what year Eaten Alive came out.
No, listen, right, because this one is about me. that's why this involves me in some way.
Yeah, so. And we all know you'll never be eaten alive.
Wow.
That's good, right?
Well, I not the way he means it.
I don't want to meet Neville Brand and be fed to his alligator.
No, not at all.
Wow. Good job, you guys. Like, oh man, that makes me want to revisit Eaten Alive and Cujo. Such good films.
Dude, so the great thing is, so my daughter is very much my child, and she is very much into horror, and she is now revisiting like all the horror movies that I grew up with, like all the 1980s stuff. And then we watch a lot of them together. Like we watched Texas Chainsaw together and The Exorcist and everything together. And it's funny looking at it through her lens because she watches The Exorcist with me and goes, looks at me and goes, So Dad, you're telling me that this is the only movie that ever really scared you? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, why? And I'm like, oh, shut up. You know, because it's just, I guess, a different sensibility. She's like, yeah, don't get me wrong. It's got shocking scenes, but I wasn't scared by them. And I'm like, well, all right, fair enough. Maybe it's just me. Religious themed horror. Even though I'm a non-religious person, for some reason, religious theme horror always got under my skin. There's something very creepy about like a church or religion having evil involved, you know? So, and I don't know why I've always gravitated towards evil, religious theme horror.
But I also think her generation grew up on movies where the majority of the scares were jump scares. And they had a lot quicker editing. Exorcist is a slow going. It's almost an hour before anything really happens.
That's true.
You know, so I can understand her perspective, but those were the types of movies we were raised on. If we were raised on, you know, the MTV type movies with the quick editing and whatnot, we may feel the same way as her.
Yeah, that's, you know, true. I grew up with my grandparents, and my granddad would tell me about seeing Frankenstein, Dracula, and the Wolfman, and being terrified by those movies. And now, you know, we watch them, and it feels very, I mean, you know, we might love those movies, but we're certainly not scared by them, you know. But I mean, being a child in like, you know, 1930s and 1940s, you know, when you'd never been exposed to anything like that before, yeah, I'm sure you would go home and have nightmares about the Wolfman. So it's interesting that every generation has their own idea of like what is scary. And, you know, because the Exorcist, like, you know, it's, I can see, you know, I can see how it'd be like, oh, that just feels like a really great character driven drama with a monster in it. And, you know, I watched that movie and I still find it like creepy as fuck and like absolutely profane. But, you know, it's, I think, you know, it's interesting to see what scares the kids nowadays.
Well, you spoke of like quote unquote elevated horror, and I hate that term too, but my daughter's favorite horror movie so far is Midsommar.
Oh, good. Yeah.
She absolutely loves that movie. And she finds it very creepy and unnerving and scary, especially because she keeps rewatching it and discovering all of like the subliminal mind tricks and visuals in the movie that are designed to keep you off kilter. You know?
Yeah. I can only imagine being a young person watching Midsommar. that would scar my brain.
Jeremiah, I have a question for you. And sure. This is kind of going back to when we were talking about Stephen King.
Yeah.
If you had the ability to adapt any Stephen King book, which one would it be?
Oh, it would be Cujo for sure.
Really?
Definitely. Because it's been a while since the 1980s film, and I would kind of want to do a version of it that's a little bit, you know, like lean all the way into the darkness of the ending. Let it play out the way that Stephen King's story does. And also the thing that King does so well in the book that is, you know, that could be tackled again in a movie is so much of it is like so much of the book is from Cujo's perspective, you know, and I wonder if there are other cinematic ways that Cujo could be the main character in the film, you know, like make Cujo almost the star of the movie. Because that would make it certainly feel different. Like I wouldn't, you know, it'd be hard to compete with Dee Wallace's brilliant performance. But if you said like, all right, we're going to instead go in the direction of like, this is going to be a dog movie. And it's going to be about a dog that we love in the beginning of the movie, like turning bad and turning scary. You know, I would like to do a take on that. My favorite Stephen King book that I wouldn't want to adapt is Pet Sematary, because I think that's so hard. It's so hard to capture the specific sad deadliness of that book, you know, and Mary Lambert's film is good. I didn't see the other version, but like, but that I remember reading that book and being like, oh my God, as a literary feat, this book is mind blowing. But I also was like, I it's very hard to see this working as a movie because it's so internal, like the internal grief that Lewis Creed is going through in that book. It's kind of hard to represent that as a movie. And I always wondered what it would be like. I know Mary Lambert wanted to cast Keith Carradine in the lead role. And I was like, he's a great actor. I wonder what it would have been like if he'd played that part.
Huh. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. But there are many great Stephen King books. Like Cujo is the one that I'd probably want to take on the most. I also really like they would never, you know, there've been so many friggin' Children of the Corn movies. They would never let any filmmaker just go do what that story is. But that story is absolutely terrifying. And it hasn't really been done as a movie, you know. And I think it would be really intense if they told Children of the Corn story in the same way that Ari Aster handles the characters in Hereditary or Midsommar. Like Bert and Vicky in that story fucking hate each other and they're at each other's throats. And for them to go into this very strange town and discover what's happening and then gradually reveal the children, you know, it's like, I don't think that movie could be, I don't think that movie, you know, there's been told so many times in so many shitty sequels that I don't think you could really recapture the magic. But I do know that reading that story, it's like, wow, what an amazing piece of fiction that is. And if only like somebody could come up with a way of telling that story in, you know, in that Harlan Ellison way, if the child could resemble the parent, who knows. But yeah, Cujo is the one I would want to do. You know, I've always thought that, like, you know, it'd be worth taking a crack at.
That would be cool.
Yeah, I love that. I love the D-Wallace film, so I wouldn't want to do what they did. I'd want to try a different way of looking at it.
I think the saddest thing, for me, the most heartbreaking thing about Cujo, the story and the movie, the book and the movie, is that Cujo himself is not really a villain. He's a good boy. And that befell a very unfortunate circumstance.
I think that's the tragedy of the book, is that Cujo is a very friendly dog and a very noble dog who is just, you know, like assailed by this evil and then corrodes into something bad. So watching somebody start out good and turn into something bad, it's kind of like the same thing that happens to Jack Torrance in the novel of The Shining, where he's trying so hard to be a good person and the Overlook Hotel just consumes him. Which is terrifying to be a good person and know that you're turning bad while it's happening. Like, I love the part in the book where Cujo sees Joe Camber's son and gets away from him because he knows that something's wrong with himself. And he knows that if he stays there, he will attack this boy that he loves. So he just gets out of there. Yeah. And it's the last, you know, one of the last gasps of Cujo's real personhood before succumbing to this madness.
I think that's one of the reasons why Stephen King's work is so hard to adapt, because a lot of it is it's internalized.
That's right.
You know, it's not a lot of big action set piece type things. It's always been very character driven, and it's always been very internal.
Yeah, and you can't get
that on screen. You really can't.
Yeah, it's tricky, you know, and that's why he's one of our great American novelists. He just gets like the inner life of so many different characters so well. You know, and like The Stand is like this epic, extraordinary novel, and it's been. I mean, even though, you know, the Mick Garris version has some really good actors in it, and the new version they did has some really good actors in it, it's really hard to capture the specific magic of that novel. You know, so yeah, it's tricky, you know, but there have been some very good adaptations as well by some great directors, you know, Brian De Palma, David Cronenberg, Stanley Kubrick have made some really interesting films out of his books. And you know, I mean, we'll see, you know, hopefully there'll be many more, we'll see what happens.
Yes.
Well,
sir.
I, for one, want to see your version of Cujo. So make that happen.
Too. Maybe someday.
Let's make that happen.
I would love to take a crack at that someday. And you know who I need to read is more Joe Hill books, because, there've been some films made. I didn't see the, Ethan Hawke movie that was based on his book.
Oh, but, the Black Phone?
Black Phone.
Oh, but, I thought it was excellent. Yeah, it's really good.
And I've been trying to, you know, it's like I've been meaning to, maybe that'll be my New Year's resolution, is to read a bunch of Joe Hill books, and then I'll watch some of the film adaptations. But I hear he's excellent.
His short stories, he's like his father. His short stories are the best. I mean, amazing. His novels are really good too, but his first collection of short stories, 20th Century Ghosts, it's still, to my mind, one of the best collection of short stories by anybody, period.
Well, maybe I'll start there, you know, and next time I'm on your show, I'll give you a full report of.
Yeah, because I'd be curious to see what you think about it.
Absolutely.
Cool. And just like that, we are we're running out of time. Jeremiah, it was so awesome for you on short notice to come on our 8-year anniversary. We do appreciate it. Scott, I hope it was a pleasant surprise. I deliberately didn't tell you.
Yeah, it's an honor to celebrate you guys and your show. I've always been a huge fan, and I've always felt like the conversations have always been so rich and so interesting. So thank you for having me on. And happy 8-year anniversary.
Thank you. And happy Thanksgiving, Jeremiah.
Happy Thanksgiving. Here we are.
Yes. Yeah, right. I can't believe it that we're about to hit Thanksgiving and then Christmas. It People tease me, but it is my favorite time of the year. I say it all the time. People think because I like horror that somehow Halloween has to be my favorite holiday. Nope. Always has been and always will be Christmas. I am Father Christmas. So I'm looking forward as we record that this won't air until after the holiday, but can't wait to get on the road tomorrow to go see my kid.
Beautiful, man. Well, happy holidays to both of you. And I'll catch up with you guys really soon, I hope.
Yeah. Listen, man, anytime, man, you got something new you're working on or you want to talk about, just drop one of us a line. You're always welcome on this show.
Absolutely.
Thanks, guys. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, man.
All right, Jeremiah. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Be good.
Well, that definitely was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, man. Like I said, I had reached out to a few people, you know, but you're right. It's the day before Thanksgiving. People are doing their thing, you know, and people were very apologetic, but just were busy. And then and Jeremiah said, oh, you know, I'll hop on. So, yeah, that was cool to catch up with him. So,
yeah. And Jeremiah is one of those people. It's been so cool watching his career just build and build and build, and him doing getting better and better and better, and being more recognized and getting more awards. It is so cool to see that happen for somebody who is genuinely one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet.
Oh, for sure. Like, and I'm not, you know, I realize he hung up. I would have, you know, I can never say enough nice things about him. And one thing that just tells you what kind of a person he is, whenever he's working on a new film and he has the opportunity, he will always reach out to me and Tom and all like the crowd, if you will, to offer us like a part as an extra or background or something like that. You know, he always wants to get his friends involved in the projects, and that means a lot. You know, he has achieved some success and just stayed the same guy, you know?
Yeah.
And I love working with him. Any chance I get, I'll be in a Jeremiah Kipp film.
And he still comes on our show.
Yeah. Yeah. How about that?
Yeah. He's always been one of my favorite guests. I can't remember. I think it was Jeremiah who put me in touch with you. Or maybe it was Tom. He put me in touch with Tom Ryan, and then Tom put me in touch with you.
That could be because I'm pretty sure the very first time I was ever on your show was the Horror Roundtable. Then I think shortly after that, you had me on as a guest by myself.
Yeah.
And then after that, you offered me, you know, to be a co-host. And here we are.
8 years later. Who would have thunk it?
Right? Yeah. You know. Yeah, man. No, like I said, 8 years. And I always mean this sincerely. Even though there are weeks where I have a bad week or you have a bad week, I do look forward to this. Every week. And I'll always be grateful that you offered for me to be a co-host on this show.
Well, I always have a blast doing it. I always have a bad week. I'm a grumpy old man.
That's true.
But I also know this, the Imaginarium probably would not have lasted as long as it had without you as my co-host, because I would have given up long ago. To ask Wade, the first 5 or 6 years of the Imaginarium, generally every fall, I kept saying, this is it. This is the last year. I quit. I don't want to do it anymore. And Wade always tells me, oh, shut up. You don't have anything else better to do. Just keep doing it. Yeah. And the sad thing is he's right, you know, and it really is kind of the highlight of my week. And I think, you know, it's kind of like my legacy, for lack of a better word. Yeah, this is going to be show number 330.
Wow. You know,
how many people can you say have done the same, done 330 of anything?
No, dude, it's a testament. Like, look, it's hard to keep something going, you know, week after week, year after year, and just stay committed to it and keep it fresh. Like, yeah, we do repeat ourselves from time to time, or we bring up the same thing from time to time. But I think we come up with good topics and we have good guests. I'm hoping, you know, to have more, you know, upcoming. So. Yeah. Yeah, man, it's a lot of fun, and it's been a fun ride. I look forward to having Kyle on next week.
Yes, Kyle Fulton will be our guest next week, and
cool.
He was really excited about it. So when I messaged him about being on, he was really excited about coming back on. So that'll be a lot of fun. And for those who don't know, because it's been long enough now that. Maybe all of our listeners don't know, but Kyle Fulton, Todd, myself, had our own kind of little political roundtable show called Mad as Hell, which that was right after the 2016 elections.
Yes.
And it was our way of venting about the outcome of that particular election.
Yes, it was.
But you can find those on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Scott Colbert.
They were fun. It was a lot of fun until Scott got a visit from Homeland Security.
Yes, yes. And I kid you not, they started asking me about my political beliefs and tweets and whatnot.
Yeah. Which is bullshit, by the way, but that's a whole nother. Yeah. That's another show. We'll wait for Kyle.
Yes, we will.
Because I'm sure he'll have some comments about that. But
yeah, because I ended it kind of abruptly, because quite honestly, when you get a visit from Homeland Security, you know, you shit your pants.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, because anyway. They can make anything happen.
What are you... what are you working on these days, my friend?
Well, I hadn't been working on much of anything because of COVID, but I started back in on the book, and it's going to be finished soon, trademark soon. And that's all I can say about that. I did finish the intro to Wade's new version of Disequilibrium, which will be out sometime next year, I think. And that's what I've got going on. Also, I may be working on this script for a short called Street Meat.
Yeah, maybe. I heard about that.
Maybe. I got some real douche writing partner on that, so who knows if we'll ever get it done.
Well, that's fair, but... I did take a step in the right direction where I did purchase Final Draft, which is professional screenwriting software, and I am learning it. And it is definitely more robust and collaborative than what I was using before. So I think we finally will be able to move forward on this script. So I did make a small step in the direction of actually working on that script. So
because I'm not getting any younger.
So there.
You know. All right. So what do you got going on?
Okay, so first and foremost, I want to give a huge thank you to everyone who donated and or shared my virtual fundraiser for Scares That Care. We did hit our $1,000 goal, and I'm very proud about that and very grateful. So thank you, thank you, thank you. We have 9 days left as of this recording. So let's see if we can go past that goal. Remember, every dollar goes towards helping us fight real monsters. So I do appreciate that. And also, when this airs, we will be only 3 days away from Night of the Giving Dead, which is Thursday, December 1st at Crossroads in Garwood, New Jersey. Doors are at 6. The event starts at 7. Tickets are $10 cash at the door. We've got awesome live entertainment. We've got burlesque from Cherry Valentine and Nola Bunny. We've got a sideshow by Carnival. We've got Nicole Oliva, who is our fan favorite and an amazing vocalist. And we've got two awesome bands. We've got Kanak, which is a local New Jersey band fronted by a very good friend of mine, Tom Kanak. And Arena Relive the Rock is coming back to play all of your favorite classic rock tunes. So I think that's a pretty good deal for $10. And it all goes to Scares That Care. And also, don't forget, it's also a toy drive. So bring at least one new unwrapped toy so that some underprivileged kids in the area can have something under the tree for Christmas. This event is near and dear to my heart. So I hope to see a lot of you there.
It will be the best Thursday night you'll ever have.
That is true. I can personally vouch for that, especially when I debut this year's holiday outfit.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So,
you know, I remember the outfit from 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I've tried. When I was on your.
When we did the virtual.
Yep. show, and I was on that. After having my nut cut off the same day, I might add.
Yes.
That's how dedicated I am to Scares That Care.
Yeah. And it was very entertaining because you were still a little looped up from the trucks.
You know, when people say they'll give their right nut for a charity, not very many people do. Yeah.
Scott did, and I actually have it right here in a little jar on my desk. Yes. So he really did. So,
all right,
that's that.
And I want to thank all of the listeners, all two of you, everybody who's listened to us currently and throughout the years. We do it because we enjoy doing it. Even if we had no listeners, we would still do it. But we appreciate people take the time who do listen, who download it or stream it, however you consume it. We're here to entertain you. That's all.
Absolutely. And
I hope you enjoy doing it as much as we enjoy doing it.
Hear, hear.
And I mean that about the podcast, too.
I was going to let that one slide.
And all right. As always, until next time, may all of your journeys be filled with pure imagination.